And welcome to Fraternal Files. This is Kersey.
And I'm Shelby.
And thank you for coming to listen to our second or third episode. We're not exactly sure which one this is yet. But regardless, thank you so much for coming and supporting our podcast. Every listen and share counts, and we are so excited that we finally are getting some content out there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And just a little apology / heads up. If you hear a few little hands or a little screaming, my daughter is outside my bedroom door.
Damn.
Sometimes just got to deal with that because mom life.
Yeah, I think I can hear one of my dogs crying outside of my door. But that's okay.
We're real, and that's all it is. It's all right.
Yeah, pretty much. I was also going to say that I listened to your mini, and that is creepy.
Isn't it so strange?
But I really liked that I could listen to a creepy little story in like just a few minutes, so I think that was a good idea.
Short and sweet.
But anyway,
I'm really excited to hear your story today.
Yes. I'm going to be telling a story today about a man who disappeared in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. This crazy story, it starts on October 2014 in the Upper Peninsula of Northern Michigan. A man, Chris Regan, he disappeared just before he was supposed to move to North Carolina to start a new job. He was 53 years old. He was 6'1", with blonde hair and blue eyes. He had a thin build and was a father of two grown boys. He was described as an athletic, adventurous, and hard worker. He was a 20-year-old, or wait, he wasn't 20 years old. He was a 20-year veteran of the United States Air Force. So he seems like a pretty cool dude. His ex-girlfriend and good friend Terry O'Donnell was the one who reported him missing to the Iron River City Police Chief Laura Frizzo on October 27th, 2014. After she had not heard from Chris in almost 2 weeks. Terry knew right away that something was wrong because she couldn't get a hold of him, and they talked almost every day. So she said that her and Chris had met in the 80s, and then they reconnected years later through Facebook. So they're older now, and they're both divorced, and they began dating long distance. They dated for about a year and a half, and then they had a peaceful breakup. So they still remained really good friends, and they talked almost every day until the day that he was reported missing. She actually spoke with Chris on the phone the morning of October 14th, 2014. They talked around 6 a.m., which was normal to talk that early, I guess. And Chris was telling Terry that he had accepted a new job in North Carolina, and he was excited to move to be closer to his son. The only thing he had left to do was to pass a drug test the following day, which wouldn't be an issue for him. He wasn't into stuff like that. After Terry reported him missing, she was able to get the police access to search Chris's apartment because her parents were landlords of his. So Terry went along with Sergeant Barrett, and they took a look around Chris's apartment where it looked obvious that he was packing to move. But Terry said that it was kind of like unusually messy despite the fact that he was getting ready to move. But they didn't find like evidence or anything suspicious other than that. Terry also knew or found that Chris's 2013 Hyundai Genesis was parked at a local park and ride, which, can you explain what a park and ride is to me, Shelby? Because I have never used one.
Yeah, so a park and ride is something that's kind of more common in big cities, especially. It's kind of like a parking lot that's next to a bus stop. So it's kind of for people that, like, if you work downtown or if you work in like a certain area where parking is either expensive or hard to find, you can park your car at the park and ride parking lot and hop on the bus, take the bus wherever you're going. And then like after work or wherever you're going, you just take the bus back to that park and ride and your car is there waiting for you.
Yeah, so I don't know. It doesn't really sound like people usually leave vehicles there for long trips. And his car was parked there for 2 weeks, about 2 weeks. And he also didn't like use the park and ride. And so, well, I guess I don't know if he didn't use it, but he loved his car, and it was very unusual that he would like leave his car there, especially overnight. So almost 2 weeks is just insane to Terry, I
Yeah,
guess.
yeah. The park and ride is like for
Yeah.
like the city bus. You're not gonna hop on like a Greyhound and go somewhere at a park and ride.
Oh, so you're not going to like Omaha.
Right.
Okay.
Omaha
So
specifically.
I don't know. That's just where everybody around here goes. Anyway, while Terry and the police searched through the car, they found a knee brace that he wouldn't have left in there because I guess he had just recently had knee surgery. So it's not like he's going to be running around without a knee brace on. And then they did get the trunk open and they were all anticipating to find something or even his body, but there was nothing in the trunk, like suspicious. And then they towed the car to the forensic lab and they tested a bunch of stuff and they didn't find anything.
Squeaky
They
clean, huh?
squeaky clean. And then they were able to confirm that his last purchase was also on October 14th at 4 p.m. at a gas station to get gas. They confirmed it with the video, and he was wearing a t-shirt and jeans. And this was like the last known time that anybody had ever seen him. And in the video, like, it just shows him getting gas, like at the pump. He doesn't come into the gas station or anything, so he must have like paid and done all of it at the pump. They weren't getting many leaves. They didn't have any leaves. They weren't getting many leads. Chief Rizzo contacted the state police for help, who started looking at Terry as the main suspect because she lived near the park and ride and she also had a romantic relationship with him in the past. Terry said that she was interrogated by two police. I don't know what's with
There's
us.
the police have no leaves.
Anyways, Terry said that she was interrogated by two police officers at her home for nearly 2 hours. But Chief Laura Frizzo, she never looked at Terry as a suspect because, like, her demeanor and character, it was so obvious that she wasn't involved. And you can, like, go look at interviews and stuff of Terry, and, like, you'll just know that she had nothing to do with this. But within days of Chris going missing, she got a call from Laura Frizzo. She gets a call from Chris Regan Jr., one of Chris's sons, and she learned that at the time that Chris went missing, he was rekindling his relationship with his son. So the father and son were rekindling a relationship. I guess they had like an estranged relationship for a while, but they were both really excited because they were supposed to be moving into a place together in North Carolina. And Chris Jr., he had like all of his stuff packed. He said he was sleeping on a cot in his apartment with boxes everywhere all packed and ready to go. And like
Gosh, so he was
he,
excited.
yeah, so they were both excited. And then it was just weird because he just never heard anything from his dad again. So he contacted the Iron River City Police like right around the time that he was reported missing, but it was like after he was reported missing because otherwise I think that probably would have been the report. I don't know. But the next suspect that they were looking at was Dale Vassar, who was Chris's neighbor at his apartment. He lived like across the hall or something from him. And Dale had helped Chris in the past put up some drywall in his apartment, some project that he wanted to do. And apparently Chris wasn't very pleased with Dale's work, but like he didn't have any other real issues with him. And I don't know what he did wrong or like what he didn't like, but I guess Chris was just a really tidy and particular person, so he just like it wasn't good enough. But anyway,
I don't think a issue over drywall is really a big enough issue
yeah.
to do something shady.
But yeah, but they interviewed everybody and so, or everybody that they could think of. And then when Dale was interviewed by the police, which was like in a police car in front of the apartment, I think, he didn't even realize that Chris was the one missing. Like he had heard that there was a man in the area that was missing, but he didn't even realize that it was the neighbor. He agreed to take a polygraph test. He didn't have any issues with that. He passed it. And then they also found out that Dale was actually out of the state when this happened. So he was removed as a suspect. Then they contacted Chris's job at the Oldenburg Group, which was in Iron River. And the former HR director described Chris as a very hard worker who excelled and moved up very quickly to a team lead position. Some people were annoyed by this because he had not been living there or working there very long, and he was just like moving up really fast, and a lot of people thought they deserved it more because of seniority. So already people are kind of like annoyed with him, but they like him. Chris's last day that he came to work was on October 14th, and he had already scheduled the next day off because October 15th was the day that he was supposed to go get a drug test for his new job, and then he was supposed to be back to work on October 16th. So just because of the dude that he was, when he didn't show up, his boss learned from other workers that he had actually accepted a job in North Carolina, and she thought that this was super weird for him to still not like tell her about it. But she just assumed that he moved early to start his new job, and she didn't report anything. So that's a big bummer. But rumor also has it that Chris was seeing someone at the Oldenburg Group, another coworker. This woman, her name was Kelly Cochran, and she was described as a married woman, very hard worker. Yeah, married, very hard worker, very charismatic and friendly and outgoing. So like she didn't have problems with anybody at work, really. I guess everybody liked her. She was normal. She had told the HR director at the time that she was having issues at home, though, in her marriage, and that her husband was abusive and that he had tried to kill her and then himself. So like a lot of people were feeling bad for her. And also, I guess like the HR director, she said that she like talked to her husband because they had like a little apartment in the back of their house or connected to their house or something like that. She was asking if like she could, if Kelly could come stay with him because of these issues, but her husband like didn't think it was a good idea. So nothing really came of it. Like they didn't do anything about this. Everybody just felt bad for her, I guess. But anyway, learning about Kelly, this led the police to go visit the Cochran house. Kelly and Jason, they met as kids, and her mom, Kelly's mom, described her as kind of like a typical teen, but she was really angsty. She acted out and she ran away a couple times. She was impulsive, and then her mom decided to actually put her in a group, in a girls' like group home type thing as a teenager. Jason actually lived next door to the Cochrans. Jason lived next door to Kelly's family, and they described him as a good kid. I guess he had kind of some of his own issues, but like they didn't really describe any of them. They just said he had his own issues and he was a good kid. He was 4 years older than Kelly, and their families would hang out and have barbecues together. They fell in love and started dating like at the end of high school, at the end of Kelly's time. And they got married later in a church. In 2000, it was February 2014 when the couple moved from Indiana to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And Jason wanted to move to Michigan for medical marijuana. He wanted to grow it and use it. Kelly said that he never had any intentions of like working there after they moved, because I guess he was on disability shortly after they got married due to sciatica. And then he also had kidney cancer at one point, which like put him out for a good 18 months. He wasn't able to work or walk or like do anything. So it seemed like Kelly was kind of like annoyed by this, but she was still like a very hard worker and took care of them. She worked at Ace Hardware, Mr. T's restaurant, and then also the Oldenburg Group in Michigan. She did end up quitting quitting Ace Hardware in June because she just couldn't like make it work. She didn't have enough time. And then she still worked at Mr. T's while she worked at the Oldenburg Group, but she got fired for attendance issues. And then they also said that she stole from them, but it doesn't say like what she stole, and she denies stealing anything, but she does admit that she had attendance issues. Kelly was actually a really smart girl, despite like never going to school. I guess she would skip school all the time. She still had a 4.0 GPA and was on the honors roll, which is like, what the heck? How do you do that? Like, when I skipped school in high school, I started failing things.
So quick, same, so quick.
So yeah, I guess she was like a genius. But she also went on to go to college for sociology, psychology, and forensics. And I think she did get like degrees in some of these things, if not all three of them. But it just goes to show that she was a really smart, hardworking person, I guess. So anyway, this led Chief Laura Frizzo to the Cochran's house. The first time that she showed up at their house, Jason answered the door, and he was super defensive, like right off the bat. He was just rude to them, and he said that he didn't know where Kelly was and that he was home alone and didn't know where she was or when she was going to be back. But moments later, Kelly appeared at the top of the steps and came to the door. So they were like, what? She was super friendly. Yeah, she was super friendly, cooperative, and offered to help with anything that she could. And then they asked why Jason lied and was acting the way that he was. Kelly said that he thought that she might be in trouble, so he just wanted to protect her, I guess. That was his way of protecting her. Lying to the police. Yeah, what did she do? Kelly said that the last time she saw Chris was on the 14th or the 15th of October, and that she had been trying to get a hold of him, but she had been unsuccessful. They told Kelly that they found his vehicle at a local park and ride, and she said she didn't know what a park and ride was. So, like, let me remind you that she was still kind of new here, and she's saying she didn't know what a park and ride was. She also did confirm that she was having an affair with Chris and that her husband was fine with it. Kelly seemed to be genuinely concerned about Chris and also said she was kind of upset because she kind of started thinking that he just moved away and didn't say goodbye. Like, he just ghosted her. During this time frame, yeah. During this Welcome whole encounter.
Club, girl. We've all been ghosted.
During the whole encounter, Jason seemed emotionless. So at this point, Chief Laura Frizzo and Sergeant Barrett both have gut feelings that something is like super weird with this couple, especially Jason. And then the next day, October 28th, the Cochrans are invited to the police station for questioning separately. Kelly was calm and cooperative. She said the last time that she saw him was at his apartment sometime between October 12th and October 15th to have dinner. According to Kelly, Chris had been at her house 2 to 3 times, and they usually had dinner every night, but at Chris's place. She also said that Chris had asked her to move to North Carolina with him, which, let me just tell you that nobody confirmed that except Kelly. So she was apparently gonna move to North Carolina with Chris, but nobody knew about this except her. Kelly, she's just weird. But Kelly explains to the detective that her and Jason had been separated, but they were still living together, that Jason was suffering with depression and other medical issues like sciatica, and he was also a cancer survivor. He wasn't able to do physical activities due to this, and so that's why he was on disability. Kelly also admitted that she was seeing another employee at the Oldenburg Group named Jason Erickson. She claims all... Yes. She says that all three men knew about each other, which later we find out that they did. They all knew about each other, but I guess they were all cool with it. I don't know. Anyway. So then they are interviewing Jason, and like right away he just starts talking about all of his health issues, and then he starts crying. he's just like super emotional the entire time. He said that he did know that his wife was seeing other men, and even though he wasn't very happy about it, he just let her do it because he wanted her to be happy. He starts talking about his health issues again and says that because of his health issues, he wasn't able to work or be sexually active. So that was why he let her see other people, because he loves her and he still wanted to be with her. And he blamed himself for like why she was straying away from the marriage.
Something is not right in that relationship.
Something is whack. Jason said he didn't even know what Chris looked like and he had nothing to do with his disappearance. They also learned that Jason checked into an inpatient mental facility on October 16th for 5 days or so, something like that. Yeah, so also keep in mind, like, while this interviewing and stuff is going on, they also have a team out looking for Chris. They had, like, military help, helicopters doing, like, the infrared thingy that it does. Dogs were looking, the whole nine yards. So,
because at this point, he's, like, just a missing person, and they're just trying to figure out where he's at, right? Like, that's why they're questioning people.
Yeah, they're trying to figure it out, but, like, I think, too, like, a lot of people didn't really think something, like, the people close to him were thinking that something bad happened to him just because this was so out of character. But, like, when a missing man, when there's a missing man, it's, like, a lot of people think, like, they just left or, like, suicide or something. So I think, like, authorities, besides Laura Frizzell, were thinking that he probably did something like that.
Oh, okay.
So, I don't know, like, they were taking it seriously, but at the same time, it kind of seems like some of the authorities weren't, like, there's like no not a
weird evidence. Woman or a child going missing.
Right, like, there's not any crazy evidence coming up or anything. Yeah, sure. But anyway, Laura was able to get some texts between Jason and Kelly at the beginning of October before Chris went missing, and Jason was definitely jealous in these text messages. He was, like, asking Kelly to come home and not to go to lunch with other guys and to just come home and be with him, and saying that, like, she doesn't love him and stuff like that. The cell phone records showed Kelly's phone at the time of some of the texts at, like, a previous coworker's house. So, like, when Kelly was texting Jason these things, they pinned it to a coworker's house is where she was at the time. So Laura Frizzell, she goes to pay them a visit. It was Lynn and Curtis Hull, previous co-workers of her at, where was it? The TC's bar. And Curtis said that Kelly was always telling him crazy stories about Jason, that he was obsessive and abusive. And Kelly admitted to Curtis of being sick of Jason and that she, like, just wanted to ship him off. Like, she wasn't, like, saying, like, she wanted to kill him. She was just saying, I wish I could just send him off to, like, a mental facility or something and just not have to worry about it. That's what it seemed like. So after this, it led Frizzell back to the Cochrans on November 10th for more questions. Kelly was friendly and allowed Frizzell to come in, where Frizzell asked Kelly and Jason to come in separately for questioning. Jason rode with Laura Frizzell to the station, and Kelly would come up shortly after on her own. Jason said that Kelly hardly spent any time at home with him and that she would usually just come home to change and then go spend time with other men, and it really upset him. He told Laura that he was also hearing voices that were telling him to kill himself and that he was better off dead. And Laura told Jason that Kelly was actually telling people that she thought Jason wanted to kill her, and he was surprised by this. Jason explained how one day when he was out walking and Kelly wasn't at home, he spotted their truck at what he thought was probably Chris's house, but he said that he didn't know at the time. He said that he's never met or, like, even saw Chris before. And with Laura pressing questions, he thinks he might need a lawyer. So right after, yeah, like, it just went downhill. Like, once he starts talking about, do you know Chris? And he's like, oh, need a lawyer. Anyway, Right after this, Kelly was being interviewed, and when asked if she would take a lie detector test, she refuses and said that she loved Chris and that her and Jason didn't do anything. Okay, girl.
I don't know if I'm more sketched out by Jason or Kelly.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Like, you'll just wait. Anyway, so then this comes in, or a new suspect comes in here. His name is Eric Erickson, who grew up in Iron River. Eric Erickson, who just grew up in Iron River, had just moved back after serving two tours in Afghanistan. He said that him and Kelly met at work. They would, like, go have smoke breaks, and then they just kind of started talking and get to know each other. He said that Kelly was super fun and outgoing, that things moved super quickly with them, and after a couple of weeks, then they started a sexual relationship. He had all the texts between him and Kelly still since, like, October 4th. It was October 4th or 5th or something like that that he had all the text messages from. He said the first place that they went to do their business was at a local park and ride.
The bitch said she said she never been to a park and ride.
I know, and get this. The first time was in her truck.
So she's been to a park and ride and she's doing the nasty at a park and ride and she's going to pretend that she's never been to a park and ride.
Right. So, yeah. And this all happened before Chris went missing. So, like, the first time that she had been to the park and ride was in September. And then also, let's see, Chris had confirmed the, or not Chris, sorry. Eric had confirmed the last time that they went to the park and ride was on October 12th.
Mm.
Chris was missing October 14th, and the last time that Kelly and Eric got together was October 12th. Eric agreed and passed a polygraph test, and he was just no longer considered a suspect. Kelly also had told Eric that Jason was abusive and that he pushed her down the stairs before. He also mentioned that some people at work were, like, telling him that Kelly was a liar. And he didn't, like, go into specifics about it. So I wonder if it was, like, crazy stories that she told or something.
Right. I'd love to know the stories.
Yeah. I really honestly don't know what they were, but yeah. Anyway, Chief Frizzo invited another coworker another employee from the Oldenburg group in. His name was Art Johnson because she found a text that he had sent to Kelly October 20th asking when she had last seen Chris. And Kelly told him that she hadn't seen him since like a week ago. And I guess this guy, Art, he knew about Chris and Kelly's relationship outside of work. And I guess he gave Kelly like a hard time about it. Like, just kind of jokingly, I think. But anyway, Chris really wanted to keep him and Kelly's relationship a secret. But when he found out that people at work knew about it, he was super mad. Like, at least like 10 to 15 people knew about it and were saying things to him. And when he asked Kelly about it, she denied that she ever talked about it, even though coworkers confirmed that they learned this from Kelly herself. So I don't know why. I don't know. It's just weird. Like, she's just weird. But by this time, months have gone by, and Laura was pretty much doing everything herself. And with lack of, like, physical evidence, the Iron River authorities thought that she was spending too much time and money and not getting anywhere. But there were still people in the community that really appreciated what she was doing. And so with help from the community, they ran a really successful fundraiser to continue with the investigation. And then in come private investigators Molly Barron and Jim McNeil. They joined Laura and start getting more information. So finally in March, Frizzo gets enough information for a search warrant of the Cochran's house. And it was in March, and they live in Michigan, so it was like freezing outside. So during the time the search was taking place, they couldn't be in the house, obviously. So they went across the street to their neighbor's house. the sailors. Their names were Todd and Dave, and it was their grandma's house, but they all lived there. During the search, they found a lot of weapons. They found knives, hammers, swords, a loaded 22, a bat. I don't know the names of all these things, but, like, when I saw pictures of them, it just looked like a bunch of, like, medieval-type shit. Like, it kind of looked like they were obviously collecting weapons. It was weird, but it was just kind of strange how they were scattered, like, throughout the house.
Like, if somebody's collecting that stuff, they're going to be, like, up on shelves and in, like, things to display them.
Right. Like, they found, like, an arsenal of stuff, I guess. And then, like, the hammer and stuff. Like, there was a hammer, like, hanging on the wall, just, like, randomly or something like that.
Like, it's some kind of workshop.
Right. And I totally get having, like, a gun and stuff. Like, that's normal. But it's, like, all the other stuff, it was just weird.
Yeah.
And then they started testing areas of the house with luminol, which tests for blood. And they did get a positive reaction on the living room ceiling, which was described as a cast-off, like the pattern of it. And I just, like, Googled it, and a cast-off, this is what it says. A cast-off results when an object swung in an arc flings blood onto nearby surfaces. This occurs when an assailant swings the blood-stained object back and forth, inflicting another blow. Analysts can tell the direction of the impacting object by the shape of the spatter. So, this told them that, like, there was something violent that happened in the living room. So, obviously, they took samples of this stuff, and they send it in, but until they get results back from the lab, like, they can't arrest them. They can't do anything. Even though they have all these weapons and stuff, like, that still doesn't mean that they did anything. So,
but, like, they obviously did some, like, blood on the ceiling.
It's
happened.
Right. So they did send it in to see, like, what kind of blood or blah, 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 and whatever. But anyway, they finish up the search, and the Cochrans, who are at the neighbors across the street, they said that, hey, we're going to go back, and then we'll be back in a little bit. But anyway, they did bring the neighbors, Dave and Todd, in for questioning. Both Todd and Dave said that they were acting super strange, Kelly and Jason were, which was really unusual. Jason was beet red, silent, and scared, which he wasn't, like, an anxious type of dude, I guess, and they've never seen him act like this before. And then Kelly was just, like, talking nonstop and super agitated. Kelly told Dave after they searched the house that they were going to go check out the house and come back. And instead, they packed up their clothes and left. So
they just, like, straight up dipped.
They just dipped. Yeah, they're like, hey, we're going to go check it out. But instead, they pack up all their clothes and then race off.
That's not sketchy or concerning at all.
Yeah, so the sailors were, like, super sketched out, and they knew that they had something to do with it. So then Laura is asking them if they heard or noticed anything around the time frame that Chris disappeared in October. They said that they did, but no one ever asked them anything until now. David's grandma said that she woke up to a sound of a gunshot or two. She didn't know if it was one or two, and screaming, and then a car door slamming, and then she also heard a man's voice say, "We got to get the hell out of here." And she said that, like, she was looking out the window, and there was, like, some trees in the way, so she couldn't see perfectly, but, like, there was a car running in the driveway, the headlights were on, and then the Cochran's vehicle, and they both left. So super sketch. She didn't know, like, the date or anything like this, but it was in October. Dave and Todd both said that they heard power tools in the middle of the night around 2 to 3 a.m. the next few nights. It was only around 2 to 3 a.m. the next couple nights. And then when they asked them what the heck they were doing at 2 to 3 in the morning, they said that they were remodeling.
Oh, yeah, just, you know, redoing the banister. And
yeah, so I don't know if, like, Kelly was, well, because Kelly made it seem like she was the only able-bodied person, so I really don't know. I don't know if she, like, said, oh, I only have time to do this in the middle of the night. I don't know what her excuse was, but sounds pretty shitty to me. But
I don't buy it, please.
Yeah, so the theory at this point is that Chris was shot and dismembered in the house. And Dave and Todd, like, they never put any of this together until now. So everything is starting to come together. Dave said that they didn't even know the Cochrans well and that they only started hanging out with them just weeks before Chris went missing. Dave and Jason would smoke weed together, and he described Jason as friendly and goofy, and he said that Kelly was super confident and flirtatious. Like, she would just compliment people. Like, it was kind of weird. And then in the days after their supposed remodel, Dave was invited over for a barbecue for the first time. And he said that there was a ton of meat. Like, he thinks, like, between $150 to $200 worth of meat. And then Jason told him that he used to be an exotic meat butcher, which wasn't true. Like, well, maybe he was, but there's absolutely no proof or evidence of that. And Dave said that the meat was, like, translucent colored and nothing, like, nothing he's ever had.
You cannot see my face, but my eyes are wide and my mouth has dropped, and I am worried.
Yeah, so Dave believes that he ate Chris. It's not funny, but yeah, this is messed up. Yeah, he ate Chris. So after,
Dave thinks that he ate Chris.
Yeah, but like, and there's not like any real, there's no real evidence of this, but like everything that happened, like, it makes sense that this happened. So I don't know. There will be more information coming, but after finding out that he is pretty sure that he ate Chris, he stopped eating meat and lost a ton of weight because of how it like mentally affected him, which I just couldn't even imagine. And oh, he felt gosh. Like he felt like totally backstabbed by Jason because he thought that him and Jason were cool. But so let's go back to the search warrant and blood samples. The blood samples did come back and they knew that it was blood, but it was so contaminated that they couldn't determine like what kind. They didn't know if it was an animal. They didn't know if it was a person, but it was blood. But that's not enough information. They couldn't do anything. But they did go back to the Cochrans and took several other things for testing, like doors and trim and things that looked like they had blood on them. And then also Laura had found some weird books, presumably written by Jason in the basement. Jason referred to himself as Quack Quack, and he called himself a predator in these books, and Laura found them super, super creepy. And in the final chapter, he describes an unwanted guest coming to the house and then having a barbecue. But this still isn't enough evidence. The forensic lab was asking if there was a way they could get DNA profiles to help them determine whose blood is whose if they were to, like, find anything. And Chris's son, he provided DNA for Chris. And then Firuza also learned that the private investigators, they planted a GPS on the Cochran's vehicle before they fled. So they were actually able to locate the Cochran's. And then they served them with a warrant for DNA. The Cochrans must have found the device, though, like, on their car. Because before they were able to find them in Indiana... Sorry, I missed this part. Before they were able to find them in Indiana, because they couldn't track them any longer, because they found the device... They asked Dave Saylor, the neighbor across the street who ate Chris, they asked him if he would record conversations between them and the Cochrans. So, like, he was trying to keep in touch with the Cochrans so that he could help the police figure out where they were. He did, actually. He did. He was the one who found out that they were at Kelly's mom's house. So they headed right to Kelly's mom's house. They served them the warrants finally and brought them in. And this couple was shook. They were like, how the heck? Why are you here in Indiana? But anyway, they got him to come in for questioning and to get DNA. Kelly treated Jason like a victim to try to get... Not Kelly. Laura treated Jason like a victim to try to get information from him during the interview. It didn't lead to anywhere, and basically he just started asking for a lawyer again. And then next, Frizzo was interviewing Kelly, where she tells Kelly that she has the text conversations and that she's been caught in all of her lies. And then she also told her that she knew that she had been hooking up with Eric Erickson at the park and ride, where she had previously told Laura that she didn't know where that was. And Kelly, being the stupid bitch that she is still denying that she knows where the park and ride was. And then she asks for a lawyer, but they were still able to get the DNA from them. So then now we're in 2013, like months after this started, and Laura orders a search for evidence in the Caspian Pit, which is basically in the backyard of the Cochran's old house. The Caspian Pit is like, I guess it's like an old mine. There's a ton of old mines in this area, and it's just filled with water, and I guess it's like the perfect place. Well, so creepy. Did you hear that?
I do hear some sirens.
Yeah, all the sirens are going off. So anyway, the Caspian Pit is basically just like a giant lake now, but it's really hard to find things in there because it's so deep. Like, they call a lot of these like old mine pits bottomless pits.
And this just also happens to be in the backyard of the Cochran's house.
Yeah, she said it was only like, I honestly don't remember, like maybe 300 or 400 or 500 or 600 or 700 yards from their house.
300, 400, 500, 600.
But it was described as yards, not miles. But anyway, surprisingly, one of the divers was able to find something. They pulled out a clothesline, which was attached to a barrel and cement block. And they did confirm that the clothesline did belong to the Cochran's by several neighbors because they had seen that it was yellow. It was like a bright yellow line. And they had seen it like outside the Cochran's house before. But because the barrel and stuff had been in the water so long, they didn't find anything like in it. But like, who does that? Another neighbor recalled that back in October when the Cochran's were having a fire, he went over to ask what they were burning because it smelled so bad. So like the smell brought him over to their house, and he asked what it was, and Jason told him that it was brush. And then he said like, no, it's not brush. And he threatened to call the police if they didn't put it out, and they did. He said that it was a smell that he never smelled. So obviously, like, to me, I'm thinking it's like a body.
Right.
But they don't have anything to confirm this still.
Right. The part of the body that they didn't eat.
Right. They did look at the fire pit, though, after this, and they did find, they collected all the ash where they found a zipper from a pair of jeans, an Old Navy pair of jeans, by the way, and a blade from a saw, but they still couldn't use these items as evidence right now because, like, there's no DNA or anything on them, and they didn't have a way to know like what jeans Chris was wearing or anything.
Right.
Yeah. So the other items found from the house in the last search, like when they took the trim and the doors and stuff, it ended up being too contaminated with paint and cleaning products. So the, like, everything had to be thrown out basically. Finally, the FBI involved, and they were able to determine from the GPS in Chris's car that he was at the Cochran's house the night of October 14th. And then they also located a rabbit's foot that belonged to Chris. Like, I feel like some people are going to say a rabbit's foot. Like, some people carry around rabbit like feet, the little like keychains.
Luck.
Right. And so, like, that but was super.
It apparently didn't bring him the luck that he was desiring.
Yeah.
No.
So some time goes by, and all of the stuff that they found in the past was never enough to, like, charge Kelly or Jason with anything. And then in February of 2016, a 911 call is made in Indiana, and it's Kelly. She's panicking that her husband isn't breathing, and she asks for them to send an ambulance. When they get there, 37-year-old Jason died of an apparent heroin overdose. Jeremy Ogden with the Hobart, Indiana Police Department. He is the one who investigates the death of Jason, and then he also looks into Kelly and contacts Laura Frizzo in Michigan, because he's just a really good detective, you know? He checked his stuff, and then he found out just history stuff with Kelly. And so because he contacted Chief Frizzo, he learns all this stuff about Chris, and then Jeremy gets involved with Jason's autopsy to make sure that the person performing the autopsy knows that Kelly and Jason were murder suspects. So at the autopsy, they find all these weird things, and then it is confirmed that Jason was actually murdered. But they didn't tell Kelly that they knew that it was a homicide at this point. Ogden, doing the good research he does, he got a hold of one of Jason's friends, Walt. And Jason and Walt met online and played games together. So they were pretty much, they just talked online all the time. And that's how they knew each other, like Facebook games or something like that. And after finding out about Jason's death, and already knowing that Kelly, one of Kelly's coworkers, went missing previously, Walt felt compelled to call the FBI. And then, so Ogden and Walt got together and they kind of like fabricated a letter, supposedly from Jason, saying that if anything happened to him, it was Kelly. So they did this so that they could like catch Kelly in lies. And Walt was the one who called her, Kelly, on March 12th, 2016, on a recorded line. And in this call, he tells her that, like, Jason had previously sent him a letter in January or something, saying that if anything happened to him, that it was Kelly. And Kelly is like, please don't call the police, or please don't tell them, please don't say anything. And Walt is basically just like, you know, my hands are tied, like, I don't know what to do. And then Kelly's like, just do what you have to do. And keep in mind, like, this letter is totally made up. Two days later, Kelly contacts Ogden on her own and said that Jason is the one who killed Chris. She said that Jason shot him and then cut him up. And then they put, like, his body parts in the woods in the Upper Peninsula. And while investigators are looking for the evidence and stuff after Kelly told them where it was at, Ogden brought Kelly back to her house so that she can, like, basically reenact the crime. And she starts explaining it. She says that Chris came to the house where they were standing at the door, which was, like, right by the stairs. And then as soon as he came in, like, they couldn't keep their hands off of each other, and they started having sex on the stairs. And then while they started going up the stairs, finally, she said that Jason came up behind them and shot Jason in the head, and then he fell backwards, like, kind of onto her, I think. And then they brought him into the basement and dismembered him with power tools. She said that it took her or them or whoever cleaned it up 24 hours to clean up the mess, because that's how much stuff there was. So she's admitting to all this, but the crazy part is, like, they've done multiple searches on the home and there was no physical evidence found of this. I mean, like, they did find the blood spatter on the ceiling, but it was so contaminated, and then, like, all those other weird spots, it was all contaminated. So, like, they couldn't find any real evidence in this house. That's how good they cleaned this up.
That is absolutely crazy.
If this is, like, your first murder, how?
Right. There's no way this is the first.
It's so weird. But anyway, she was supposed... There was no physical evidence found in the woods where she led them. So, yeah. She was also supposed to... She was supposed to meet with Ogden again in a couple days for, like, questioning or interview or whatever again. And she just didn't show up. She fled. I think she had sent that police officer Ogden too a text message that said, like, the West Coast looks nice this time of year or something like that. And then she fled. So she even, like, gave them a warning that she was going to fled, like, go. Like, I don't get her. They were able to pin her location down from her phone, and then she was arrested in Kentucky and charged with Chris's and Jason's death. Kelly also told them then after she was arrested that on her and Jason's wedding night, they made a pact that if either of them were to have an affair, that they had to kill the person that they were seeing. And then if they didn't, that they were going to kill that other person.
Oh my gosh.
Apparently her story is that she didn't want to kill Chris, so Jason did it. And then she was, like, so mad that he did that, that she decided that she had to kill him later on, I guess. That was her story. After she was arrested, she led the detectives back to the wooded area, and the only remains found were by a dog, and it was his skull. It was Chris's skull, yeah.
Oh.
And then she also led them to more evidence back at the house that they missed. It was a pair of forceps that she used to try to get the bullet out of his skull. And they ended up finding evidence on that. Like, they did find Chris's DNA on that after she had already been arrested for the murder. And then they also found the gun that was used to kill him. This is also really... Yeah, this is so crazy. So a lot of this information that I got, it was from this documentary on ID, I think. I watched it on the Discovery app called Dead North. And while they were filming the documentary, like, they went back to the wooded area where they had found the skull. And this was a year and a half later after they found the skull. There was a dog out there, and they, like, just found the bottom part of Chris's jaw, too. Like... unsuspectedly, they found more of Chris. It was just crazy, and they were just so shocked. But anyway, Kelly was sentenced to life in prison, and it's actually believed that the Cochrans have killed at least 9 people, and their bodies have never been found.
Oh.
Yeah. And I guess there was, like, a plea deal that she had that carried, like, she had a 65-year sentence for Jason's murder, and with the plea deal, I guess maybe, like, she had, sorry, I should have got better details at this part, but I think she had, like, said that there were other victims, but a part of her plea deal was that, like, if anything was ever found, she couldn't be charged with it. But regardless, she still had, like, a life sentence for Chris's murder, too.
Right.
So, like, she's never going to get out. But it is really sad that, like, if she really did kill other people, like, there's never going to be justice for them.
Yeah, that is sad. Most killers, once they get convicted, they'll, like, tell you who else they killed just because they can get the notoriety then.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, that's, like, cool. You can, like, find drawings that she drew in prison that are super creepy. And it's just weird. And, like, I personally think that she really has to be, like, a crazy serial killer. Like, she definitely has more victims because what they did was, like, Dexter-type stuff.
That's exactly, like,
they knew
what
they were doing. They knew what they were doing.
That's exactly what I was thinking. There's no way a first-time person... And then to be that calm afterwards, too, just because you know they're not going to find anything. Like, right. They're definitely experienced.
And then also one, like, cool thing that came out of this story was that Jeremy Ogden and Laura Frizzo, they fell in love and they're getting married.
Because
they're both, like, bomb-ass detectives.
Wow, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
What a cute little origin story for the relationship.
Yeah. But anyways, if you stuck and listened to my entire story, thank you so much. Because, you know, I, like, have to write a script basically to tell you guys a story because my mind is insane. And I cannot keep track of everything.
It's hard to make sure that you get all of the details.
It really is.
But it's not as easy as it seems.
It really isn't, because like I have listened to every podcast I can find on this case, and I've watched documentaries and I've read stuff, and where in my mind I feel like I store all of this information and I feel like I can talk about it. It's so hard to just like tell the whole story without, you know, like straying off.
Right, for sure.
But that yeah, this really... is one of my favorite cases, and we will post sources under the episode description. Yeah.
We'll get some sources and some pictures posted. We'll post some pictures on Instagram as well when we release the episode. You can follow us on Instagram at @FraternoFiles. And we also have a Twitter now, also at @FraternoFiles. We have a whole 0 followers if anybody wants to be the first one.
Well, I didn't even know we had a Twitter.
I just made it.
Thanks for doing all of that, Shelb.
Mm-hmm. And you can email us at fraternalfilespodcast@gmail.com. And thanks so much for listening.